A church is a living fellowship, more than a holy shrine, where people can share their hopes and fear, less of yours and mine. Where bonded by trust, we search for truth beyond the chains of creed, and thought can aspire to shine with fire from our deepest needs. Good morning, everyone, and welcome to the Unitarian Church. You're very welcome, all of you who are sitting here in the pews, everyone who has joined us online, or anyone who happens across the service on the internet at some later stage. You are very welcome. Anyone who's here for the first time, you are particularly welcome. But also welcome, very welcome, are the people who have found a spiritual home here. My name is Pamela McCarthy, and I'm a member of the congregation here. We have a long tradition of open pulpit. People are allowed to share their views and their ideas with the congregation. This is an open invitation if anyone feels that they would like to take the service, if they have something to say, if they have read a book, or if something is exercising their mind. You can talk to Gavin, and Gavin will put you on the schedule for a later date. Begin the service proper with the chalice lighting. We light this chalice as a symbolic act to establish a time in our week when rituals have meaning, stories tell the truth, and the spirit speaks louder than words of the transcendent mystery of creation and of our place in the universe. And now we'll sing our first hymn, hymn number 106 from the hymn book, Who Would True Valor See? Hymn 106. Oh, that was wonderful. It lifts my spirits. I love that hymn. Let us pray. Let's stretch out the open hand of love, conquer the fists of hate, divided no more by voices of war, greeds of our mindless state. We'll take all our building blocks of truth, make of them homes of life, a future to face the shame and disgrace in all our past of strife. Let's turn to the back of our hymnal and say the prayer there. Love is the doctrine of this church. The quest of truth is its sacrament, and service is its prayer. To dwell together in peace, to seek knowledge in freedom, to serve mankind in fellowship, to the end that all souls shall grow in harmony with the divine, this do we covenant with each other and with God. Our reader this morning is Sherry.
This reading has been prompted by a couple of actions I've experienced in this church over the past year or so. The actions of people who I highly respect for their spiritual practices have caused me to wonder if there is a gap in understanding about what it means to be Jewish. When someone expresses that Jews would not, in their worship, pray for others than themselves, what negative ideas about Judaism and Jewish people underlie their statement? When someone I know is sincere in their desire to demonstrate inclusiveness, uses music associated with the Holocaust, music distinctively Jewish in style, to criticize the Israeli government. What gap in understanding does this reflect about the significance of the Holocaust for Jews? And these actions, inadvertent and unintended, unfortunately, have caused me to feel a bit unwelcome in my own church, to ask myself whether I am welcome in spite of my Jewishness, or including my Jewishness. And then I came across an opinion piece in the Irish Times by Jared Howland. I love this church and I found it helpful, so I'm going to share it with you now. It's called Ireland is not anti-Semitic, but it's not a good time to be Jewish in this country. Ireland has a problem with how Jewish people are treated here. We are perceived as being a cold house for Jews, and I'd say that is about right. Today in Washington, Taoiseach Micheál Martin is scheduled to meet representatives of the U.S. Jewish community. After the hijinks of the last few days of his U.S. trip, this is an opportunity for reflection. The meeting, according to the government, is to discuss the rise of global anti-Semitism and actions by Ireland to combat anti-Semitism, both at home and internationally. Anti-Semitism is on the rise across Europe, and Ireland will hold the presidency of the EU in the second half of 2026. We have ground to make up if we are to claim honest broker status on this issue. Part of the problem is the decibel level here of discourse around the Middle East generally, and Gaza specifically. Little is said below the level of shouting. There is no space left here for either a broader perspective or nuance. There is, however, an increasingly automatic overlapping of Jews with Israel. Zionism has become a term of abuse. The politics of this unfurls on the streets, online, and in the media. Irish Jews and Jewish people in Ireland are increasingly uncomfortable. There are unquestionably lurid examples of outright anti-Semitism, but that is not the national mood. However, there has been an outbreak of carelessness and insensitivity and systematic negligence until very recently in terms of engagement with Jews in Ireland, a population that is relatively small and diverse in views. There is no monolith, no them to speak of, but Jewish people describe a palpable sense of being somehow less of this place than before. That's a shame, and the shame is on the rest of us. If my small circle of acquaintances is a guide, there are few cheerleaders for the current Israeli government among Jews in Ireland. But that is not the point. To be Jewish in Ireland is to be burdened with assumptions and the captive audience for chilling rhetoric. They describe not wanting to be on the streets on those days, avoiding the city center so as not to be confronted. It is not a good time to be out, proud, Jewish and Irish, Jewish in Ireland.
Sherry, thank you for your reading. And now for the children's story. The children's story this morning is not a once upon a time story. This is a story of something that actually happened to me. When my younger granddaughter started visiting our house regularly, she wasn't too sure about the house. She looked at it and me and her granddad with a certain amount of trepidation. So one day I was walking around the house and realized that it wasn't really a very enticing environment for a small child. So to solve this problem, I went and bought a teddy. So the next time the little one came to my house, I said, look, I have a teddy, and his name is Gilbert. Every time you come to my house, you can play with the teddy. Well, she looked at me with the kind of disdain that only a small girl can muster, furrowed her eyebrows and looked at me and looked at the teddy and said, it's not a teddy, it's a soft toy. And Gilbert is a really stupid name for her. I am never playing with that soft toy ever. I was totally taken aback by this. I didn't know how to respond. But while I was there, standing with my mouth open, she dashed over, picked up the only other toy in the house and said, I'm going outside to play with Topsy, and shot out the back door. The dog, meanwhile, was looking at this and was totally shocked to see her toy disappearing out the back door in the hands of this visiting child. But dogs react so much more quickly than people do. Before I could say or do anything, the dog dashed up, grabbed Gilbert and shot out the back door to play with him and the visiting child. They were very happy. Adults really should not be involved with small children and dogs. Our second hymn this morning is hymn number 281, O God, Our Help in Ages Past, hymn number 281. The second reading this morning is an extract from the book Open Socrates by the academic philosopher Agnes Callard, an extract from Open Socrates. At around age 50, the great Russian novelist Leo Tolstoy, who lived 1828 to 1910, experienced his life unraveling. He reports, "My life came to a halt. I could breathe, eat, drink, sleep, and I couldn't not breathe, eat, drink, sleep. But I had no life because I had no desires in the fulfillment of which I might find meaning. If I desired something, then I knew in advance that whether I fulfilled my desire or not, nothing would come of it. If an enchantress had come down and offered to fulfill my desires for me, I wouldn't have known what to say." Agnes Collard writes, "A person moves through life by envisioning positive outcomes, either for herself or those around her, and working to bring them about. If there is nothing that could happen that would satisfy you, motivational collapse ensues." The fact that Tolstoy could face such a collapse is an alarming indictment of the very concept of success. Since very few human lives have been characterized by more substantial success than Tolstoy's, Tolstoy's life came to a halt after he had written War and Peace and Anna Karenina, and more generally, his life was going just about as well as it possibly could for a human being. Tolstoy's crisis was caused by his inability to answer certain questions. He had everything he wanted in life: literary fame, a loving family, wealth, physical and mental stamina, but finds himself plagued by the thought that he cannot understand why he cares about any of these things. Tolstoy writes, "Before occupying myself with the Samara estates, the education of my son, the writing of a book, I had to know why I would be doing that. As long as I didn't know why, I couldn't do anything. As I thought about estate management, which engaged me a lot at that time, there would suddenly come into my head the question, 'Very well, you'll have 16,000 acres in the province of Samara and 300 horses. And then what?' I was completely thrown and I didn't know what more to think. Or starting to think how I was educating my children, I would say to myself, 'Why?' Or considering how the welfare of the people might be achieved, I suddenly would say to myself, 'But what is that to do with me?' Or thinking about the fame my works had brought me, I would say to myself, 'Very well, you'll be more famous than Gogol, Pushkin, Shakespeare, Molière, than all the writers in the world. So what?' And I couldn't answer anything, anything at all." The above quotations come from a work called Confession, in which Tolstoy describes a period in his life when he struggled with these questions and found them unanswerable. Through Confession, Tolstoy is tormented by the problem of how to move on. By his own lights, what Tolstoy discovered is that the examined life is not worth living. You'd feel like adding God love him as a postscript, but yesterday was the summer solstice, so for the prayer, I'm going to read the prayer Summer Solstice by Mahada Thomas, and that will be followed by a period of silence, and Josh will bring it to an end by playing us some music. Summer Solstice. O radiant and glorious sun, illuminate my body, mind, and soul. Show us how to bloom where we are planted. Bless the seeds of growth and change. Help us to be whole. And we will rise like you in full glory. Time speeds as summer calls us to action. Much work has been done. We can expect more when flowers become fruit. In our busyness, make space for sacred pause. Allow yourself to stop, simply to be. Bask in the moment. Harness sun's energy to fuel activities ahead. Expand in summer. Contemplate a higher consciousness. Keep faith. Pray for rain where there is drought. Pray to temper the wildfires. Pray over your gardens. Pray for the salmon. Pray for the waters of the world. Pray for the suffering. Pray for peace. Your prayers are compassion in action. We have the power to direct the storm, focusing our energy for the highest good. Welcome sun into your heart and ignite inner light. Shine on sisters. The world needs your unique, radiant beauty. Amen.
Thank you.
The book Open Socrates by Agnes Callard is a joy to read. She's very, very clever, but very easy to read, and she makes references to a whole lot of interesting works as well. I think it's almost, for me anyway, it's almost an education in contained in a single volume. But when I started reading the book, I was kind of wondering about myself. Am I more mad than usual? What's going on in my life? This is just crazy. I was thinking, there must be some reason for this that I'm interested in Socrates. I mean, come on. He was a contrary, difficult individual who caused a whole lot of problems everywhere he went. And even though we still read the stories told about him, nobody likes him that much, really. I mean, come on, he was really a difficult individual. And then in the introductory chapter, there's a whole lot about Tolstoy, another difficult individual. And then I got to thinking, when I was a teenager and was worried, frightened about the future, I read Solzhenitsyn. I read almost all of Solzhenitsyn. And then that phase went away and I read much more light-hearted literature. Then again, in my 30s, when I was finding life hard going, I read Tolstoy. I read most of Tolstoy. And was very glad when that phase moved off and I didn't have to face any more of Tolstoy and his real hard life. I mean, come on. But then, next stage in my life where I was possibly going through a period of fear, I read the Gospels. Some of the Gospels were quite interesting, not a bit helpful, but they were very interesting. And then, a couple of years ago, when the whole COVID thing was going on, I discovered Jordan Peterson. He got me through COVID to a large extent, after family and friends and the social supports. But it really cheers me up no end if I'm feeling worried about the state of the world or the state of my own life to turn on a YouTube video and have Jordan Peterson shout at me. He's just marvellous in his therapy. He speaks a lot of sense, but all of them do. I mean, starting with Sophocles, Solzhenitsyn, Tolstoy, Jordan Peterson, they have two things in common. They're contrary, difficult, middle-aged men. And second of all, they are very, very clever. They have a lot to say that we could perhaps benefit from. Now, perhaps to return to the main point, I called the address Listen to Socrates because Socrates didn't actually write down anything. We assume that he was a literate Greek and that he could read. He just didn't. He didn't read much and he didn't write much. He spent his whole time walking around the street, so far as we can tell, bothering people. And what we know of him comes down from the writings of seriously clever writers from a range of topics in ancient Greece. The first accounts of Sophocles' life come from Aristophanes' marvellous drama, Clouds, where he is portrayed as being a complete nightmare to have anything to do with. Xenophon wrote about Socrates, but most of what we know about Socrates and his thoughts come to us from Plato. So sometimes it's difficult to separate out Plato's thinking from Socrates' thinking. Despite his lack of writing down his life story, we know quite a lot about Socrates. He was born sometime around 469 BCE. His father was a stonecutter and his mother was a midwife. He was married, he had children, he had a place in Greek Athenian society. He was one of the well-off people in Athenian society. Lightly he fought in the Peloponnesian War. Then in 399 BCE, he was charged by the city of Athens with impiety and corrupting the youth. He was tried, found guilty, and executed. So much for the bare bones of his story. But like Tolstoy, Socrates hit a crisis point in his life when he was confronted by profound questions that he just could not answer. But Socrates decided that rather than despair, that he would confront these questions And he reckoned that it was the best thing that had ever happened to him. He devoted his life to seeking answers for the hard questions in life, the why, the what for. And not only did he look for the answers to these questions for himself, but he insisted that everybody around him take up this crusade as well, whether they were interested or not. There is a story told about Socrates that his friend Chaerephon went to consult the oracle at Delphi, and he asked the oracle whether there was anyone wiser than Socrates in the world. And much to Chaerephon's surprise, the oracle said no. So he came back to Athens and he related this to Socrates. He said, "What do you think of that? There is nobody wiser in the world." And Socrates, he had a fairly balanced view of himself, and he knew he wasn't really that clever, and there were an awful lot of things he didn't know, so he was surprised by this. And he eventually came to the conclusion that the reason he was esteemed as being wise because he knew there were a whole lot of things he didn't know, and perhaps that's the start of wisdom, knowing that there are things you don't know. For myself, Gilbert is helping me with that every day. It's a reminder. Socrates was of the view that all our troubles, all our dissatisfactions, all our failings, all our failures to progress, our moral imperfections are down to ignorance. That it's impossible for us to act against our own best interests. And if we but find out the answers to questions, become wise, all of our problems will disappear. And he challenged people from calling ignorance by other names. He wouldn't hear of people referring to lack of willpower, laziness, or even just plain malice. No, no, no. It's all just the same problem. It's all ignorance. And he also warns of the dangers of acquiring knowledge from unreliable sources. In this, he's having a poke at the Epicureans and the Stoics, because the Epicureans figure that all our good information comes from our bodies. Our bodies tell us what we need to know. Whereas the Stoics took the other view, that we're social beings and that if we can, we need to respond to the society of which we are a part, and that society will nudge us into behaving and being the way we should be. The Socratic approach to life, the way to tackle our ignorance or to develop more knowledge, is a threefold part: inquiry, open-mindedness, and truth-seeking. This sounds very easy when I say, look, all you have to do is inquire, be open-minded, and seek the truth. But each of these comes with a built-in paradox. When it comes to inquiry, we hit the buffers with Meno's paradox. How can you inquire if you don't realize that you need to find out about something? I mean, there are a whole lot of things out there that I know nothing about, and I will probably continue for a very long time without bothering any of these things. So the question is, how do you find out about what you don't know you need to learn about? Now, some of this comes to us through the natural processes of life. You find yourself in a situation where you need to know something you don't know, and it's causing you a whole lot of problems. So you spend 20 minutes learning something, and then you sort out the problem, and you don't bother that lack of knowledge again. When it comes to open-mindedness, there's a paradox for that too. If you want to be technical about it, it's Moore's paradox. This is a suggestion that all of us are capable of recognizing that there have been times in the past when we've been wrong. And for most of us, we accept that there will be times going forward when we will be wrong. But it is almost impossible for your average human being to say, today I am wrong. And this is the open-mindedness that Socrates feels we need to recognize where we are wrong today and correct our wrongness. And not to say, oh, well, that was yesterday and I know better today, or this will perhaps in some time in the future I may be wrong again. No, no, he's not letting you off on that. You have to face up to where you are wrong today. The third part of the Socratic path is truth seeking. He feels that it's very important to seek the truth. But of course, this is Socrates. There has to be a problem. I mean, it's not simple. Why would he make anything simple when he can make it all more interesting and convoluted for us? He said that truth seeking is not just looking for the truth, but it's avoiding falseness. If you have the truth, to seek the truth, you have to avoid falsehood. And really, this is where Open Socrates is quite interesting. He said that this is something that none of us can do on our own. That if we're seeking the truth, it needs to be a two-person operation at least. One person is actively seeking the truth and saying, propose something that, say, this is true. Being in church on Sunday is a good idea. Having a teddy is a good idea. Reading books is a good idea. And then you have a dialogue with somebody who refutes everything you say. So you have one person who proposes truths and the other person refutes it. And that this is a way of coming to a better understanding of ourselves and our world. Agnes Callard is absolutely insistent that this is something that nobody can do on their own. We each have to have a companion. We have to have somebody who will refute for us, who will challenge us, who will tell us, no, no, you got it wrong there. I think this is one of the joys of living in a congregation like this. There are so many people who have refutations for quite a lot of the silly ideas and the not so silly ideas we have all been exposed to. And they will gently point out to all of us, me included, the error of our ways. It's wonderful. Now, in Tolstoy's case, he gets a smack from Professor Callard because she figures that he didn't actually investigate the questions enough. He just laid down in a sulk and didn't actually seek answers to the questions. He felt that he'd done enough when he just asked the questions. And he eventually found solace in religion. Now, his experiences with religion were somewhat mixed. He had a strong belief in God, but he didn't like the New Testament, so he wrote his own, rewrote his own. So I think there has to be a balance in our lives between our toolkit for how we cope with the difficulties in life. There should be room for rational inquiry. But we should also perhaps recognize that there are situations where rational inquiry really doesn't do us enough. Maybe we need the supernatural, we need God in our lives, perhaps, but certainly we need people in our lives. And I think he was perhaps too dismissive of the Epicureans and the Stoics. If you don't look after your body, if your body is telling you, like, I'm hungry, I'm tired, it's very hard to have a good life. At the same time, if you spend your life sitting in a dusty library without contact with the rest of the world, our lives would become really rather unpleasant. I think perhaps for me, when the chips are down, the writer that gives me most hope comes back to Solzhenitsyn. I mean, Solzhenitsyn was just so clever. A Day in the Life of Ivan Denisovich. Poor old Ivan Denisovich was in a terrible situation. He was having the worst day anyone could imagine. And yet, somehow, he found the courage, he found the spark. He was able to say, I'm not letting this get me down. I'm going to carry on. I'm going to get up and take another step forward. I'm going to live my life. What we need to do, perhaps, is to find ways that work for us in different situations. Socrates, by all means, follow the Socratic path. But don't feel that it will give you all the answers when maybe it won't. In the words of the old hymn, adventure boldly and explore. Amen. We will now have our third hymn, hymn number 124, Be That Guide, and it will be followed by the collection. Thank you, Josh, for the wonderful music. It's always a pleasure to hear the music in this wonderful building. Thank you to Jennifer for making way to Shari to give her the opportunity to express the thoughts that were weighing down on her. Thank you to the welcomers, Alison and Dennis. Danielle, thank you for the flowers. Maeve, Grania, and Daniela are looking after coffee. So after the service, please come downstairs for coffee and a biscuit. The book club meet on this Wednesday at 7:30. The book for June is Tell Me Everything by Elizabeth Strout. The book for next month, July, is James by Percival Everett. It's a revisioning of the Huck Finn story, so I think it's going to be a really interesting book. Sundays at 2 p.m., the new initiative is led by the Classical Musicians Network, who meet here in the church, and it's organized by Shari. The second hour-long concert is next Sunday at 2 p.m. Entry is free. Donations can be made towards the Restoration Fund. Wednesday lunchtime, as usual. The Unitarian Walkers meet on Saturday, the 12th of July. Frank Tracy will lead us on a walk around the Liberties. The walk will begin at 11 a.m. at the Four Courts Lewis stop. Next Saturday, the 28th of June, is the annual Dublin Pride Parade. If you wish to march behind the Unitarian Love banner, let Gavin know. The march will start at 12:45 on O'Connell Street. It will take about 2 hours to reach the finishing point in Merrion Square. Gavin is proposing that anyone here who wants to march meet up in front of the Gresham at 12:30. And next Sunday, the 29th of June, our annual Pride service. Please invite family, friends, colleagues, anyone who'd be interested in coming to this event. Thank you all for being here. I hope you have a good week. Our final hymn is hymn number 67, We Sing Now Together. A church is a place of human trust, more than brick and stone. Of love we will sing to make it ring in every joyous tone. May the quality of our lives be our benediction and a blessing on all whom we touch this day and on the days going forward. Amen.